AM 7:30. Glad you're along today. I know you're going to find this topic very, very interesting as we have a chance to talk with Curtis Greco from the imperfectmessenger.com. You can read some of his information there. And really, I know that for me, it's been a hard topic. We had Tuesday night the president give an address to the nation. We got folks giving ideas about it. We just heard from Representative Steve Pierce on his thoughts there. And there's a lot of ideas going on, but we wanted to touch on it today on 11 o'clock live because that's one of the topics we want you to be informed on. What's going on in the Middle East right now is a huge, huge story. In fact, it has really eclipsed the things going on in Japan, which I find a little surprising too. Curtis, I appreciate you joining us on the program today, and I know we've got a very interesting time today.
Well, you know, it's always great to be on air with you. You have a poignant and a precise way of diving into critical issues, and I can't tell you how delighted I am to be with you and explore these points with you and share them with your audience.
I'm excited to have you. And I'm just going to start with the first question that comes off the top of my mind. I would just like to get your response. So we did some of this the other day on the program, but kind of your response to what the president had to say to the nation on Tuesday night.
Well, Mr. Obama, to his credit, is an extraordinarily gifted orator. Not particularly because of what he says, but more so how he says it. You know, he has this wonderfully bold and eloquent rhythmic process that he can engage the listener into. And before you know it, you actually find yourself thinking, well, this is pretty interesting. It's engaging, you know. He sets the mood as he wishes without complete regard to the reality of what is actually occurring. What we see with what Mr. Obama has done, and of course this is not really unique to Obama. This, you know, the presidents of in the past always take on a sort of bully pulpit type of a routine. But Mr. Obama does something that no president in the past has ever been able to do and do so as effectively. And that is to completely redefine a premise, to completely redefine an image without regard to the limitations that are in the background. Recently, I made a post that said one of the things that is unique to politicians in the United States is they get to completely make a statement without having to support it, right? They get to, it's incredible. So what we see, what Mr. Obama has done with his speech earlier this week, was he has completely redefined the role of the United States as a global police force, or as he put it, as a global security force. And he's done it in a very unique way. In one way, he says the U.S. cannot use its military force around the world in whatever way it wants to. But then he immediately goes in to say how he can't stand by and let certain things happen. So in effect, what he's done is defined the parameters by which he can choose to actually act. And by acting, basically draw the U.S. into a further and expanding role as he sees fit. All they've done is he's redefined it by simply now defining military incursion as a humanitarian effort.
Very interesting, yeah.
And when you do that, the way he's done, it's basically, in effect, allowed the administration to tie potentially the U.S. to just about any area around the world that he chooses to do.
Well, do you see that as part of the fact that he redefined the United Nations, the Council passed, did he redefine that in some ways to make it fit more what we wanted to do there?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and again, you know, if you read the resolution and then you read how Mr. Obama defines it, there's a kind of a very interesting sort of reinterpretation of reality. Again, he gets to define it the way he wants it to appear when he says, and further, on one hand, they say it's purely a humanitarian effort, right?
Right.
But then he says the UN resolution further authorizes all necessary measures to protect the Libyan people. Emphasis on all necessary measures. Well, whenever you define it that way as the parameters of what constitutes a justifiable action, what's eliminated?
Well, you leave that open. It's like a blank check.
Oh, absolutely. So, you know, if we step back from the immediacy of the issue of Libya and we look at this greater role and this greater objectivity, let's say, of what's happening in the Middle East, and you follow the patterns and you connect the dots, again, I can't help but look back at the historical similarities to other events that drew the U.S. into greater global conflicts. And, you know, let us not forget, you know, what's ironic is the military action here is called Odyssey Dawn, right?
Yeah, that's interesting, too.
It's interesting when you think about it, because if it's in reference to Homer's Odyssey, right, we should remember what happened to the warriors who were returning after Homer's epic battle with a 10-year siege of Troy, as I remember. They stopped on the North African coast area, which is an area now what we think of as Libya. And, of course, they sent scouts out for water and food who never returned.
Mm-hmm.
Then you look a little further forward and you look at the exploits of the Germans and the Italians in the North African coast. And then later on in World War II, the battle that the U.S. got drawn into in the North African coast. But step back even further than that into the 1800s when the U.S. Navy got into a little match with the what's called, if I remember, the Tripolitan War of 1801, and the USS Philadelphia was captured. I mean, what I'm getting at is it's a black hole, just like the rest of the Middle East. We look at the Middle East in U.S. Western terms, this sort of sophomoric interpretation or impression that we can intellectually adapt the Arab culture into this organized, structured Western method of what we refer to as democracy. And somehow, simply because we can park some warships off the coast and send some Tomahawk cruise missiles that cost between $800 and $1 million per, that somehow we're going to dramatically alter the historical patterns and historical traditions of the tribal factions of the Middle East to suddenly one day wake up and be, you know, democratic institutions. it's not
yeah.
going to happen.
Exactly. Curtis, that's the other thing I think I find interesting, and maybe it's part of the same idea of this redefinition, is one of the things the president was very clear to say, I guess all the news media really hung on it, and they kind of treated it like this was, okay, we can now take a sigh of relief because the United States is going to give control of the operations over to NATO. But really, in my mind, that's not doing a whole lot because we are the primary force within NATO.
Absolutely. I mean, remind our listeners or your listeners that NATO is nothing more than an extension of military or political U.S. military political influence. The 80%+ of the so-called NATO surface fleets are, of course, American warships. The U.S. Provides all the intelligence and support for NATO. The U.S. funds NATO 22% of the NATO annual budget. In addition to the armaments that the U.S. provides, the U.S. funds 22% of the annual budget of NATO.
Wow.
Plus the fact that I may have the labels incorrect, but if my memory serves me correct, the Supreme Allied Commander Europe is always a post held by an American. And the Supreme Allied Commander Europe is the boss of the NATO commander, who is now, in theory, being assigned the task of the Odyssey Dawn. So, you know, this is, it's one of these little subtle shades of gray that Mr. Obama likes to use to give the public the impression that all is good in the world, when in fact it's just simply, another convenient reinterpretation of reality, which I think draws us back into a big question, I think, that we all should be asking, and that is, I invite your audience to go back and read the first president of the United States, George Washington's farewell address.
Okay.
And in the farewell address, Mr. Washington talks about the great risk to the U.S. of meddling or being dragged into foreign entanglements. No country in the history of mankind has ever survived a permanent war footing. And what we see here in the U.S. since World War I, is a permanent war footing that has dragged this nation not only into foreign incursions, but has exhausted the economic capacity of this country. And when we look at all of this and we step back and say, you know, there's all of this chaos going on in the Middle East, whether it's this sort of illusion that's being sold to the public to justify the U.S. involvement or to sell the public into suppressing their intellect into questioning what's happening, what we have actually have to do is step back and look and say, okay, we've got this stuff going on in the North African continent. You reach over to Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, the Yemeni coast, down into, of course, the Saudis are having issues. What is driving all of this? Now they're about to toss the Israelis or Israel into the fray by, I'll tell you to watch for this because it's coming. They're going to force a Palestinian state on Israel. And this is going to be a this is another part of that sort of a comment I made earlier about the U.S. taking the sophomoric approach that we can somehow reorientate the Middle East to fit this little cookie cutter that we've created that somehow they should conform to. But what we need to understand from an American perspective, from a perspective of the average American, and I don't mean average meaning ordinary, I mean the people who live and breathe and work and die that make this country work, the 300 million Americans who are sold on these illusions of the just cause that drags us into these apocryphal battles in foreign lands that exhaust not only our economic components, but the lives of our most sacred component of this country, and that is our youth, into these concepts that make really no sense to the lifeblood of this country. And I think that's the questions that we need to start paying, not only asking, but we really need to start paying closer attention to.
You know, I think you have an interesting point there, Curtis. A lot of things come across my mind when you say that, obviously the economic side of it. But I want to ask, I remember back during the 1920s, the United States really kind of moved into more of an isolationist point of view, 20s and 30s especially. But then we were kind of surprised by what came on. If we pull back from, as you called it, that continued war footing, aren't we going to move toward isolationism, or is there some kind of a happy medium that we can reach here?
Well, the irony of this term isolation is always used as a punitive assault against the sovereign interests of the United States. I would have to ask, you know, when you talk about it on an economic scale, when you hear the conversation that we need to have these trade agreements and we need to make the U.S. more competitive in a global economy, and if we go and do all of these things, the composition of this is an assault where they'll say, we can't return to a state of isolationism. Well, my point is this. Isn't it more appropriate that a congressman or a senator or a president of the United States should take a nationalist position in deference to the U.S. and its economic strength and its domestic agenda? If that requires an isolationist so-called notion, then how can that be wrong? In other words, my point would be better said this way. If a U.S. senator and congressman are going to act in opposition to the strength of the U.S. being economically sound domestically, sociologically sound domestically, then who in their right mind would not want to be an isolationist nation? The illusion or the term of isolationism is a false argument. It assumes that the term isolation means that somehow you are sacrificing to defend and protect your sovereign interest. That's the equivalent of the argument is to call a soldier in battle an isolationist because he's carrying an M16, right? Mm-hmm. To protect your sovereign interest is the sacred goal, is the sacred purpose that lies behind the oath of office that every elected official in the United States takes. The term isolationism is, again, a false argument. It is the argument that is used that says to combat the idea that says, let's take care of business here at home first.
Mm. Very interesting. Well, what about the economic impact? What sort of economic impact from what's going on in Libya do you foresee upon the United States? I mean, obviously, we're spending, you mentioned $800,000 to $1 million, maybe a little more for every one of those Tomahawk missiles, and granted, they're all ours, and we'll have to replace those, and right. There's a lot of big money there. But if this goes on, it seems like we're already having problems with the budget deficit. We're going to be spending a lot of money.
Well, let's take some quick points. You know, right now in the House in Washington, the argument is being waged over a measly 2% of the deficit, and this issue of whether it's going to be $60 billion or $30 billion, and the Democrats only want to do $10 billion, and the Republicans and the Tea Partiers are pushing for this big whopping number. What folks need to remember is what they're arguing about is only 2% of not of the budget, it's only 2% of the deficit. That is 2%. They're arguing over reducing what they don't have. This is incredible.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's number one. On the second issue is, and this goes, and maybe we'll have more time before we part to go into the more deliberate domestic agenda, economic domestic agenda. But on a global issue, remember that we're already nearing almost $1 trillion invested in this Middle East incursion under Odyssey Dawn. Almost $1 trillion. Now, this completely has wiped out all of the so-called savings that they're even talking about on Capitol Hill today, plus all of the budget reductions that were done with these last two continuing budget resolutions, and the adventure in the 12th-hour passage back in December before in the lame duck Congress. So all of these savings in one fell swoop, in a matter, as Mr. Obama would say, in 30 days, we have managed to completely wipe out whatever savings they may have logged.
Wow.
So let's step back and go to the question of how does the Middle East affect us? One of the reasons I make the comment when I say we need to step back, I don't necessarily mean withdraw. What I mean is, you know, sometimes when you look real closely at one issue, you forget or you do not see the collateral issues. If we pull back from a very precise and encapsulated view of the Libya issue and we draw back our perspective and look at the entire composition, I am composed of thought to the degree where when I look back and take in a global view of what's happening, what I clearly see, and you and I have talked about this before when we talked about the battle that's waging between China, Russia, and the United and Western interest.
Mm-hmm.
It's important to remember that folks understand that the global economy is lubricated by the world reserve currency, which is the United States dollar. Whenever any country in the world wants to buy a commodity on the global markets, they must first purchase dollars to acquire them. China and Russia do not like this. China and Russia do not want to be forced into being submissive to the Western financial regime that is the Western-style banking system orchestrated by the Bank of International Settlements in Switzerland. But as it is, that's the battle. They understand that the lifeblood of the global economy at the moment appears to be oil. And the idea is that the Chinese and Russians have long since been looking for a way to submarine the Western dominance, economic dominance. And one of the ways that they have attempted to do this is by altering either one of two things, that is, either the world reserve currency that is booting off the world stage, the U.S. dollar, which in some ways could be the biggest gift to the American people than any one single act, but that requires a little more discussion. Or they can affect a different mechanism whereby oil is traded around the world. And one of the battles that's being waged in this economic war and why the Middle East is so significant is the Middle East strategically is a natural barrier between the interests of the West and the interests of the East. Okay, whether it be Pakistan and Afghanistan and Iran, the old Persian Ottoman Empire, and the Himalayas that are in the north of India that come up behind Pakistan. And so these are interesting observations to look back and say, wait a second, is the U.S. really being drawn into the Middle East because of the humanitarian issue, or is it more likely that the historical interest of the pattern that has always been the firing lines that have distinguished influential boundaries between Western and Eastern influences, is it more likely that what is taking place in the Middle East is actually orchestrated to continue to defend the Western dominance of economic dominance? Now, that's a big picture item, and I know it's sometimes often difficult to get hands around it, but more importantly, to draw it back to the American public, let us not forget that since World War I, the U.S. Has persistently and consistently been called upon to defend these foreign incursions, whether it be World War I, whether it be any of the skirmishes that took place post-World War I into Korea, whether it was the incursion into Vietnam that was triggered by the Gulf of Tonkin incident, and every adventure that has occurred since then. And so I resolve to the question to my fellow Americans, and that is this. If you're really going to argue this question of the police force role of the U.S. as a global mechanism to monitor global economics, are we really prepared to now submit, as a country of 330 million people, to a globalized agenda, the price of which is your sovereign rights of self-determination? Remember, when we got to look back and say to ourselves, do we hold to be true the implicit message in the popular and sacred text of the Declaration of Independence? If we truly do hold these truths to be self-evident, then what we are doing and have been doing is completely opposed to that regime of thought.
Mm. Well, Curtis, what you're saying has some huge implications, because definitely when we talk about, is this playing into the idea of increasing globalization and the reduction of the U.S. sovereignty and our own individual rights, and it's all part of that redefinition, and a lot of folks aren't seeing that, and I'm glad you pointed that out. I think that's a real key.
It's very important because it goes to the heart of what's happening in our country, what's happening on the political side of the aisle. When we look at why is you and I both know, and your audience knows, that there's a fundamental economic truth about our personal finances. You cannot spend more than what you earn. And when you find yourself in an economic conundrum, it's very simple. You either increase your income or you cut your expenses. Right? This isn't economic. You don't need to go to Wharton School of Business to figure this out, right? So why is it that the Congress, why is it that state governments don't get the simplicity of fiscal responsibility? Moreover, why are they so unwilling to drag the bull to the ground and resolve it?
Hmm.
I'm more perplexed. I did a talk last week in front of a group of almost 4,700 people, where we talked about the pitch that the topic we were talking about was this very issue of taking this role of the global police force, this globalized perspective of drawing Americans into this belief that somehow we have a duty to this global management. The way the president projects it, we don't have a choice. In fact, he says so in his speech. I have no choice. Right?
I remember that, yeah.
Well, who's right, Mr. Obama? By what presidential mandate that exists in the implicit doctrine that is the Constitution of the United States that not only entitles you to make this declaration, but also entitles you to draw a nation into this belief system that is clearly contrary? This goes to your question about this idea of isolationism. That's a complete canard. It's a completely apocryphal statement. There is no such thing as isolationism. If you go to the reality of how you deal with your daily life, it is no different how you manage a nation, and that is you must first take care of your business, your personal responsibilities, your personal duties to you and your own. The president has a sacred duty to his own, and that is you and I. I don't have an issue with Mr. Obama. After all, he is the president of the United States. Moreover, he's the president of 330 million people.
True.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And,
wow.
And he has a duty to defend and protect the Declaration of Independence, because that's not actually true. But he does have a duty to defend and protect the people of the United States and the Constitution of the United States, as do every congressman and every senator.
Very, very true.
And we're not doing it.
Yeah. Wow. You know, there's so much to consider in this, and that when we look at this conflict in Libya, we say, wow, suddenly it paints a different picture. Do you think Congress is going to be able to act on this, or do you think they're going to continue to play out? I've only got a couple more minutes, but I've got to ask that question. Is they're going to continue to let it play, or will they?
They're going to continue to let it play, and I'll tell you why. It's a real simple answer. The only way the Congress can deal with what the president has done is to call him on the carpet, because that he has not only violated the War Powers Act, but he's also breached the boundaries of executive authority. And so the only way that they can call him on the carpet for that is to sanction him. And I just do not see the Congress or both houses ever taking on a definitive role of sanctioning the president. They won't do it. For whatever reason, and I've got many reasons where I can explain why that's the case, but it's highly unlikely that they'll do it.
That's kind of what's my thinking, too, but I'm glad to hear it from somewhere else. Well, Curtis Greco, again, it's been a pleasure to have you with us, painting some pictures here that definitely provide some food for thought. And we're going to talk again next week about the upcoming election, and we'll see how this plays into some of the things that we've been talking about here. But let's point folks to your website, to your blogs, because there's places they can read more and even interact with you some, too.
Absolutely. I welcome your audience to the Imperfect Messenger Foundation. That's the Facebook name is the Imperfect Messenger Foundation. The website is theimperfectmessenger.com. You can find your way. There's the icons at the top right of the home page where you can become a follower on Facebook. You just click on the link, or you can follow us on Twitter. And it's a great resource for some of these very unique perspectives that are largely lost on the media. And, of course, welcome you to pick up the book series. That's an engaging three-book series that goes into some of these more passionate pleas of historical references as to why the United States exists and why it must be preserved. And I invite everyone to become a patent follower and possess and execute a voracious appetite for the information. It's that good.
Sounds good, Curtis. Again, we'll talk again, I know, next week. Check it out, theimperfectmessenger.com, or on Facebook it is the Imperfect Messenger Foundation.
Thanks again. Always a pleasure to be with you. Thank you for the time, and all the best to you and your audience.
Appreciate that, Curtis. Thanks again, and thanks for being so informative. Enjoyed having you with us today on the program.
Take care.